Okay. Good morning, everyone, and welcome to another week, week seven of the series, which we have called Unlock, based on Edith Eger's book, The Gift. Just before we start, just once again, so we're going to have today, and then next week also, next week will be the last Thursday morning session of 2020. We're going to start again at the end of January, but as I mentioned last week, this year, knowing that a lot of people are not going away and there's people around and so on, we're going to be doing different learning opportunities, smaller ones or whatever, over the 7 weeks. After next week, we have 7 weeks, from the 13th of December till the end of January. So please, we sent an email a few days ago about it. There'll be some WhatsApps and emails and so on. So just, if you can pay attention and just read them. Some of the things you need to sign up to some WhatsApp groups for and so on. So there's going to be lots of different learning things, like daily. One of them will be a daily personal growth message, which I'm going to base on the teachings of Rabbi Dr. Twersky or Rabbi Sachs, one of the two, each day. It'll be the inspirational videos. There's some other learning shirim online and so on, or through WhatsApp, which we're going to be doing. So I don't want to leave the summer an empty spot. So there is lots of different things, even though some of us will be taking off a bit of time here and there, but there's plenty to keep us going throughout the whole summer, so please refer to the emails and the messages. So just a little review of last week. Last week we did the prison of resentment, talking about hate and resentment being something that is destructive, preventing happiness, can inflict pain, and so on. And we found that in the Torah, there's this prohibition against don't bear a grudge, which means don't hang on to stuff from people. And the point we made was, the basic point we made was that resentment has more to do with the person, meaning has more to do with what's happening inside of us when we harbor resentment than with what is going on with the other person, what the other person did. In other words, we have within ourselves a lot of times unresolved stuff, which needs to be resolved in order to move forward. We made the distinction between resentment and seeking justice sometimes when it's appropriate. The difference is resentment is always an escape and it's a cover-up for our own problems, where justice means holding people responsible, holding others responsible, and ensuring that no more hurt actually takes place. So just to run through some of the strategies we talked about last week, which is obviously to strengthen our faith, emunah, with the belief and the acceptance that everything is bashkacha pratit, everything is by divine providence and therefore has a reason and a purpose. We talked about the importance of having a vision and a goal. Doing acts of positivity often fills us with positivity, learned optimism, connections with community, friendship, family. Exercising good emotions, like exercising gratitude and forgiveness. Then, of course, Achrei Ma'asim Mishach HaLevavot, the famous concept that the heart follows the action, and therefore, sometimes we just engage on a behavioral level in doing things which are more celebratory and happy rather than resentful and positive and negative. We become that way and we're able to let go of the resentment. So those are some of the things that we talked about from last week. Before we go into this week, I just want, as I did last week, just mention, and sort of with a bit of urgency because we're now closing up the calendar. The calendar, thank God, thanks to many of you, have done very well this year. But we do have an extra feature this year where we have a page of boxes that look like Zoom boxes, and we're highlighting the different stuff that went on during this year for COVID. And people can sponsor boxes for $36. Some I urge you to participate. And if you can contact the office, 9365-2241. And they will, or email them and they'll organize it for you. Okay. So today, what I want to do is I want to draw some inspiration from two chapters in the book. Partly because we're running out of time, but secondly, because in truth they are connected. And those are the two chapters. The one is called The Prison of Fear, and the other one is called The Prison of Hopelessness. Okay? Both both very important. So let's begin with some of the things that she talks about fear, because it's certainly something that holds us back. Fear is a paralyzing emotion, something that certainly holds us back from growing, from developing, from doing things, from accomplishing things, from becoming a better person, and so on and so forth, because fear paralyzes the person who's just doing nothing, essentially, or just continuing on, with cruise control, just sort of stuck and carrying on like normal, which doesn't do well for growth, of course. So I'll begin with some of the things that she writes at the beginning of the chapter about fear, and she says the following. She said, "I've been teaching psychology at a high school in El Paso for a few years, and had even been awarded Teacher of the Year when I decided to return to school for a master's in educational psychology." Okay, so we know that. She studied very, very late. "One day, my clinical supervisor came to me and said, Edith, or Eddie as they called her, you've got to get a doctorate. I laughed," she says. "By the time I get a doctorate, I'll be 50. To which he replied, "You'll be 50 anyway." And she says, "Those are the smartest four words anyone has ever said to me. You're going to be 50 anyway, or 30, or 60, or 90. You might as well take a risk. Do something you've never done before. Change is synonymous with growth," she says. "To grow, you've got to evolve instead of revolve." Such a good line. Often we go through life and people do the same thing, revolve around, it's a revolving door. You keep going around, stopping at the same stations again and again. But growing means, no matter what age it is, because we grow and we take risks and we do new things, no matter at what stage of the journey we might be, and we go to the next step. "In America," she writes, "the slang term for a psychologist is shrink. But I like to call myself a stretch, to meet people, survivor to survivor, and guide you to realize or release your self-limiting beliefs and embrace your potential." Then she says, we are not stuck in the past or stuck in our old patterns and behaviors. We are here now in the present, and it's up to us what we hold on to, what we let go, and what we reach for. So that's a little bit about fear. In other words, her point is fear is a paralyzing thing. It holds us back. It doesn't let us take risks or grow, but it's up to us. We choose to let go of fear or to hang on to fear. Now, just before we go on to some of the things she says, I think it's important to highlight that there's different sources for fear, right? There's fear of failure, something that we've discussed many, 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 many times, which, of course, fear of failure is a very mistaken concept. Often we are afraid of failure because we define ourselves by the things we succeed in or not, or fail in. You know, it's not even to do with the perception of others, just the way we define ourselves. We hold ourselves to be a successful person if we do good things or if we accomplish amazing things. But we define ourselves by our failure. So therefore, if I do something and I take a risk and I fail at it, I am now a failure. So I've defined myself by that failure. And that's problematic. We also make the mistake, of course, that we perceive our goal in life as the end outcome, as the thing that we have accomplished. In other words, it all got to do with the final product, which is so untrue, as we've talked about many, many times, because it is completely the opposite. The goal of life is each step. Of course, we have long-term goals, and we should, as we'll talk about later as well. We should have long-term goals, but the goal for now is what I'm doing now, the step that I'm taking now, the effort that I'm putting in now. And as we know, as the teachings of Judaism tell us, that every step of the way, every time we try, every time we overcome something, even a little bit, in any aspect of life, that is tremendous success. Even if we are trying to move away from something negative, from something toxic, we're trying to move away from jealousy or anger, whatever the case is, and we haven't yet succeeded, but the very fact that we committed to it and we're taking steps towards it, each step is something amazing. So therefore, we cannot define ourselves by our failure, because each when we try to do something, the trying itself is amazing. The other, of course, related problem is, which has also got to do with fear, is that we are afraid to take risks because not only do we define ourselves by our own successes and failures, we define ourselves by the perception of others, which is something we've talked about greatly. But all that adds to fear. So fear, letting go of fear, making that choice, as she says, obviously includes also letting go of hatred, as we talked about last week, but letting go of those erroneous thought patterns. Those thought patterns of defining ourselves by the wrong things, defining ourselves by failure, defining ourselves by success, defining ourselves by the perception of other people, and so on and so forth. So that's some of the source of fear. But sometimes fear actually comes from a legitimate source. When I say legitimate, means it's a good reason. It's not a mistaken reason. But even then, we have to know that we can let go of fear. Now, when I say legitimate source, I'm talking about past experiences or betrayals, which leads us to be very fearful for the future or untrusting of the future. And this is something Edith Eger talks about in the book, and I'm going to read to you just one of the stories she tells. Sad story, very, very sad story. She said, it's an extreme story, but it happens to everyone a little bit on some level, and that adds to the fear of taking the next step. She says, Gloria is still carrying a heavy burden. She fled the civil war in El Salvador when she was 4, grew up in an extremely violent household where her mother was repeatedly beaten by her father, and then when she was 13 and visiting family in El Salvador, she was raped by an uncle. And she tells Edith Eger, she says, I'm holding on to so much anguish and hurt. Everything is covered in fear. I don't want to lose my husband or children to the past. I need things to change. I just don't know how to change or where to start. And then she says, now, along with the frequent intrusions and feeling of panic from the past, she lives every day terrified that her children will be harmed the way she was. And that's completely legitimate, meaning completely understandable, right? If something happens to us, if we were robbed, we get scared of going to sleep at night. If we get, God forbid, attacked in the street, we'll be scared to walk in the street or for our children to walk in the street. People have survived past trauma. People have survived very traumatic and negative experiences, often manifest itself in the way they bring up their children in terms of being overprotective and so on and so forth. So that's a problem. And just in this story, she continues to talk to Edith. She says, I do my best to make sure that they're safe. She said, but I won't always be there to protect them. I don't want them to live in fear. I don't want to pass on the fear. But everyday events like dropping her daughter off at camp provoke enormous fear. I'm up at night thinking, what's going to happen to her? Is something happening to her right now? We should never stop. So she writes, we should never stop seeking safety and justice, doing everything in our power to protect ourselves, our loved ones, our neighbors, our fellow humans. But, says Edith, we have a choice of how much of our lives we give to fear, over to fear. Because fear uses words. And now she talks about, this is one of the strategies she uses in the book, she talks about messaging. We need to be in touch when fear is coming from a good place, meaning from a legitimate place. Not from a completely erroneous way of thinking in terms of how we define ourselves and so on, as we spoke about before. But when fear comes from a good place, what it does is fear creates certain messages that we play in our brain. And one of the things she talks about is rewiring, rewording those messages, because that's a very famous and powerful strategy, of course. She says, fear uses the most insistent, relentless, provocative words, like what if. When fear comes like a panic storm and your body shakes and your heart races and the trauma you already survived threatens to swallow you, take your precious hand and say, thank you, fear, for wanting to protect me, and then say, that was then, this is now. So sometimes when we're scared, and scared based on previous experiences, we do have to just strengthen ourselves. We do have to reword those messages. We need to, because as we've talked about before, and I think we talked about this a lot when we talked about the coming from within, that series we did, and how some of the strategy is about the story we tell, and it's retelling our own story, right? So language has a very big effect, as we know, communication, even the language we use by ourselves and to ourselves. So rather things I can't, and I just can't do this, and I'm not going to, and I'm going to fail, and I'm going to succeed, and something's going to happen, and so on and so forth, we need to reword those things and start telling different stories. Start saying, I can do this. I don't know what the future holds, but I'm going to give it a big shot. I have trust in Hashem. I'm going to do it. I'm going to succeed. So she says, nothing is guaranteed. That's true. We live in a world with danger. And so we live in a world of fear. Your safety isn't guaranteed. That is true. But fear and love don't coexist, she says. And fear doesn't have to rule your life. Releasing the fear starts with you. And of course, if we don't let go of fear, not only are we not able to move forward, but what happens is that fear becomes a self-fulfilling prophecy very often, because the way we think breeds an energy. The way we think sort of also creates a narrative and creates a story, and sometimes we want to fit into that story. So it becomes a self-fulfilling prophecy and it becomes a cycle, and therefore fear is something, even when it comes from a legitimate source, it's something that we do need to let go of and reword and reinterpret it and try and let go of that fear. Now, I'll just mention some of the strategies that she mentions and also add one or two. She says, again, we need to, the first strategy she says is, for one day, keep track of every time you say, I can't, I need, I should, and I'm trying. I can't really means I won't. I need means I need, and I should means I'm abdicating my freedom of choice. And I'm trying is lying. Eliminate this language from your vocabulary. You can't let go of something unless you replace it with something else. Replace the language of fear with something else. I can, I want, I'm willing, I choose, I am. And then the second thing she says is always to remember that change is synonymous with growth. So we need to make sure that every single day of our life, and this is true on all levels, that we need to grow. We need to do something that is the next step. It might be small, but it's something which sometimes is hard, something sometimes is scary, but we need to confront it and move forward. And of course, as we spoke about with some of the other negative emotions, she talks about identifying your fears and then letting go. So we need to know what we're scared of and why we're scared, and that's okay. It's a certain consciousness, it's a certain awareness of where we are and what we are feeling. We need to get used to that feeling and then learn to live with it and let go. And of course, we can't talk about fear without talking about the concept in Judaism of emunah and bitachon. And of course, bitachon is something to learn about, to think about, and to really exercise, to trust, to have the emunah that things that have happened in the past had to happen for whatever reason, but then to move forward with trust in Hashem, thinking positively, as one of the great rebbes said, most famously, he said, tracht gut, he said in Yiddish, tracht gut wird sein gut, think good and it will be good. When we trust in Hashem, when we surrender, when we give up control, because don't forget, fear is also a form of control. It's about, I'm so scared because I know if I do this, this is going to happen. We need to give up control. We need to let God rule the world. And we have to trust in Him that things will actually turn out okay. And of course, that goes together also with mindful living. She doesn't talk about it so much, but it's so important. One of the ways to overcome the fear is to let go of tomorrow. Let go of next week. Let go of next year. But in order to do that, we can only let go of the future when we learn to be present in the moment, in the current moment. So when we take each moment separately, you know, often we think about, I can't do that, I'm overwhelmed, it's not going to work. We'll do one thing towards it now. Do one thing towards it the next moment. Break it down into the present, break it down in being present. All of that helps to remove and to take away the fear. All right, now, that's all true, but perhaps worse than that is the second chapter I wanted to draw some inspiration from, which is the prison of hopelessness. You see, it's interesting that fear is very negative. I mean, it has its positives at its place, but it's very negative. We're too scared to do anything when we become paralyzed. But fear is still an emotion. You know, when a person is scared, they're alive. They're still alive. And when a person's alive, I mean alive in the symbolic sense of being alive, that life force can be channeled. Can be transformed, it can be channeled. But hopelessness is something different. Hopelessness is not an emotion. In fact, it's an absence of an emotion. It's just giving up. And often it comes with numbness. I'm giving up, I don't care, and doom. It's not resentment. Resentment is an emotion. I hate the person. Fear is an emotion. Hopelessness is the absence of an emotion. It's the precursor to depression. It's just nothing. It's what we call in Talmudic language, yush. Yush means giving up hope. And when we give up hope, then we really are stuck. There's nothing more stuck than not believing that there's any hope. So let's just explore this a little bit. Let's start with some of the stories she tells, some of the things that she points out. First of all, she talks about Auschwitz and how easy it was to lose hope there. Because she says the following, very beautifully written, as always. She says, in Auschwitz, I was haunted by a persistent thought. Does anyone know Magda and I are here? Magda's a sister. Does anyone know that we're here? Do we exist? I mean, can you just imagine the sense of loneliness or the sense of abandonment, really, more importantly? What must have been where they knew that their parents had gone, been taken away, killed, whatever the case is. And like, does anyone know that we're here? Does anyone know we exist, right? And she says, the problem was that any answer pointed to hopelessness. Because if people knew we were here and didn't intervene, then what was the value of my life? And if no one knew, how can we ever get out? Right? So hopelessness coming from a real thing. And then she says, when hopelessness overwhelmed me, I think of what my mother had told me in the dark, crowded cattle car on the way to prison. We don't know where we're going. We don't know what's going to happen. Just remember, no one can take away what you put in your mind. So therefore, she goes on to say how she could have just given up hope, but she didn't. She started to visualize things that could happen after the war. She started to think about her boyfriend. She started to think about her parents and so on and so forth, right? And she explains how you know, she envisions, as by the Viktor Frankl says this too, like he used to think of himself as a teacher in a classroom and so on and so forth, hanging on to something, believing in something, hoping for something. And that's how she survived, she says. And she says, hope is really a matter of life and death. And she tells a story of people who gave up hope and then not long after they weren't around anymore. Right? And of course, her big thing, like in her previous book, is to really emphasize that hopelessness at the end of the day is a choice. Again, it's like fear. There can be very good reasons to feel hopeless, but at the end of the day, feeling hopeless is a choice. But choosing hope affects what gets my attention every day. I can think young. I can choose what I want to do and fill my day with passion, to dance as long as I'm able to, and so on, to read books, to spend time with people who are kind and have integrity, to remember the loss and trauma doesn't mean you have to stop living fully. And then she says a beautiful thing. She says, you've seen firsthand the greatest evil of the world, people say. How can you hold hope when there's still genocide in the world, where there's no evidence to the contrary? So she says the following. She says, to ask how hope is possible in the face of dire realities is to confuse hope with idealism. That's a very important point, she says, right? Because as we often talk about these things, hope doesn't mean that you're in some parallel universe, right? She says, idealism is when you expect that everything in life is going to be fair or good or easy. It's a defense mechanism, just like denial or delusion. And then she says a line, honey, don't cover garlic with chocolate. It doesn't taste good. Likewise, there's no freedom in denying reality or trying to cloak it in something sweet. Hope isn't hope as opposed to idealism. Hope is not a distraction from darkness. It's a confrontation with darkness. And this is the really, really important thing here, because it's not idealism or some sort of delusional hope and denial, because that comes back to backfire, and that just creates very, very negative sort of smashing of hopes and so on and so forth, expectations. But she says, hope is not idealism. Hope means you are very well aware of what's going on. You are aware of the dangers. You are aware of the hopelessness. You are aware of the isolation. You are aware of every challenging thing that is taking place, and yet you choose to hope. Because you know that something is beyond all of this. There's something to look forward to. There's something that might take time, but we don't give up on it. That's true hope. And she says, but hope is the boldest act of imagination that I know. So what does it look like? So I think one of the ways to understand this, of course, is, you know, as Jews, the Jewish people, we are a people of hope. You know, and that itself is an unbelievable thing to think about, because there are many things as a Jewish nation that we do unbelievably well, collectively, as a community, as a nation, and often we don't do it so well individually. Right? We, as a nation, live with hope. Our DNA is hope. Our DNA is dreaming and imagining what could come next. We never give up. The resilience in the Jewish people is unbelievable. In fact, there was a Sephardic sage called the Chida. The Chida, he was a very, very big Sephardic sage. And he says the following. He says, you know, that if you look in the Amidah, every day of Shacharit, every day I would do an Amidah, during the week, that is, right? There's a prayer, there's a number of prayers, but there's a prayer for Mashiach. There's a prayer for a better future. There's a prayer for the time that Mashiach will come. There'll be peace and it'll be almost a utopian existence. And we know that in our belief in the 13 principles of faith, Mashiach is a man who comes from the house of David. He has to have that lineage, the tribe. So we talk about him as David HaMelech. That's part of what we mean, by the way. We say David Melech Yisrael Chai V'Kayam. He's everlasting. Obviously, he's not everlasting. He passed away, but it means his spirit, his legacy lives on, but his descendants will be the king again, right? So in the Amidah, we say the following words. We say, Etzemach David Avdecha Meheira Tatzmiach. The Tzemach, the growth of your servant David, let it sprout quickly, which means as Mashiach comes. And then we say, Ki lishu'atcha kivinu kol hayom. Because for your salvation, we hope every day. What does that mean? What's the connection? Again, it's saying to God, please bring the redemption. Let the sprout of King David's descendants sprout forth very quickly. Because we hope every day. What's the because here? Says the Chida, this is exactly the point. We say to Hashem, you know why you need to bring Mashiach? Because we have not given up on it. Because it's 2,000 years since the temple was destroyed and we still fervently believe that it's going to happen. We fervently believe in a better future. We fervently believe in a temple coming down to Jerusalem and so on and so forth. So, Meheira Tatzmiach, gather us, bring back Mashiach, build the base of Mikdash. Why? Because we haven't given up on it. Because we hope for it still. Even though at times it seemed completely hopeless. But we as a people do not give up. We are very good at this. We are very good at not breeding, collectively at least, hopelessness. The problem is that we don't always take it and transfer it from the collective to the individual, from the community to the person. Sometimes in our own lives we just fall apart. We've never given up on the Jewish people, but we give up on ourselves sometimes. And that's sad. In other words, we never give up on what's going to happen to us collectively, but we do give up sometimes on what happens to us ourselves, and that's really, really problematic. And that's why we need to learn from what the Chida says, that Asemach David Avdecha Meheira Tatzmiach, that Hashem, just like we ask Hashem, please bring the salvation because we haven't given up on it, so too in our own lives. When we have a goal, when we have a mission, when we have something we know we need to do, but it's not going so easy, we don't give up. And because we don't give up, we trust that it's going to happen and we rely on Hashem, it happens. One day, the next day, partially, the whole, it doesn't make a difference because again, like we said before, the outcome is not irrelevant. And yes, of course, we have bitachon, as we said before. We have trust in Hashem. But we know that it doesn't always exactly turn out the way we want it to turn out. It's going to turn out good, but not always the way we planned it. Because as we always say, we should plan. It's a responsible thing to do. But our life does not take us to where our plans are. Sometimes God has other things in store. He gets us get stuck and land up somewhere else. Because our mission has to take a different path. So never giving up, surrendering to the will of Hashem, and understanding his infinity to rise above the challenges, all those things is so important to eradicate the concept of hopelessness. Hopelessness is not a good thing. It doesn't have any function. But what we need to do is we need to take this idea and try and apply it individually, apply it to ourselves. One of the ways we do that, of course, again, like she says in the book, it's not ignoring the darkness, it's having hope, embracing it with the darkness. I'll just share with you a little story of the Lubavitcher Rebbe who the way he believed in what could happen and believed in purpose and believed in the strength and hope and hopefulness of the individual was astounding. He always believed that as long as we're alive, we can accomplish, we can reach, we can grow. right? As long as we're breathing, we can still grow. Someone once came to him, you know, the famous Sunday morning dollars. Someone once came to him, an older person, I don't know, a person in 50, 60, whatever the case is, and they told him, and by this time the Rebbe was like in his 80s already. And they said to the Rebbe, they want to retire. Because the guy said, I'm not getting that young, I'm a little old already. So the Rebbe, in a twinkle, the twinkle in his eyes, said to the person, well, I'm not very young either, but I have plans for 10 years, and after those 10 years, for another 10 years. And I was, I've got big plans, I have big goals. I'm working on each one day by day, but I've got big goals because I don't give up. And when people suffered setbacks, he didn't give up either because he saw the setbacks. This is the concept of not being idealistic. Understanding the challenges, but exercising hopefulness with the challenges, with the darkness. I just want to... Rashi says like that. Again, just go back to that line, such a beautiful line. Hope isn't a distraction from darkness. It's a confrontation with darkness. So a little story I just picked up on a couple of days ago. I was just looking at the story at the book called Positivity Bias, and it's about the Rebbe's positive outlook. And he tells a story there about a young American boy. This was in the 50s. This is when the Rebbe was just becoming a Rebbe. 1950, 51, 52, whatever. And there were several young American men who had a secular background but eventually found their way to Yiddishkeit, and they were sort of enrolled in the yeshiva in Brooklyn and so on. One of them was a student from Chicago, and his name was Mendel Greenbaum. And just after a few months, after he began studying in the yeshiva and was really enjoying it and connecting to it and loving the experience, he gets a letter, a draft notice, that he had been drafted into the army. And he turned around to his friends and says, he's so upset. He says, while I was not engaged in Judaism, I explained to my friends, I had all the time in the world and I misused it. Now I've begun to appreciate the importance of time and I'm using it productively. Now suddenly, how could God do this to me? Now I've come to yeshiva, I want to learn how God do this to me. So, He was worried that going to the army, he would be so upset about this, being drafted in against his will, that he would actually end up giving up his Judaism, his Torah, mitzvot, would suffer. So he went into the Lubavitcher Rebbe to seek guidance. And the Rebbe said the following. The Rebbe said, sometimes in life, one must take a step backward in order to be able to go forward in the future. The young man remained silent with a puzzled look on his face. When the Rebbe saw his bewilderment, the Rebbe got up from his chair. He got up from behind his desk to illustrate the point. He took a chair and he said, listen to this interesting analogy. If I wanted to jump over this chair, I couldn't do it because I'm right in front of it. But if I would just take a few steps back and get a running start, I could gain the momentum required to clear the obstacle. An amazing analogy. So what he was telling him is, you are thinking you have a setback. The setback isn't a setback. It's part of growth. It's part of you taking a leap and a jump forward. But in order to take a leap and jump over an obstacle, you need to take a few steps back sometimes. So what happened? He ended up going to the army and he ended up becoming amazingly successful in Judaism. He became a bit of a source of inspiration to other people. He says, I continue to faithfully observe the mitzvot, finding time to prayer. But following the Rebbe's advice, that this was something about taking a step forward, he says he started to have reaching out to dozens of other Jewish men and servicemen, you know, asking them to put on tefillin, to make a step forward, to take on something, a mezuzah, kashrut, whatever the case was. Right? And he became a leader. In other words, what he thought was a setback. And at the time it was a setback because it was away from his plans, and not just any plans. It was away from good plans that he had done. The setback was just about taking a few steps back in order that he could take a jump over, remove an obstacle, and achieve even greater heights, which he did. He didn't get to have his plans of learning in yeshiva, but he became a real leader and subsequently became a rabbi, whatever the case was. What the story demonstrates, of course, is a principle which we have in Hasidic teachings very often. It's called the Yerida Tzorech Aliyah. Every time in life when we experience a setback, when we experience a descent, yirida means to go down, it is for the purpose of aliyah, it's for the purpose to go up. In other words, life is about growing. Life is about accomplishing and going forward and going from step to step and becoming closer and closer to the godly goal of life. But sometimes there's challenges in the way, there's obstacles in the way, and sometimes before we can go even higher, we need to experience some sort of setback. Because the setback gives us a few steps back to run and to overcome the obstacle. So it's not about idealism. It's not about ignoring the challenge. On the contrary, it's about being very conscious of the challenge. But turning it around and saying, I am conscious of the challenge. I realize the challenge. And that challenge is there for me to take a step back and to have a running start and to jumping over the obstacle. But you need to know that, you need to know the challenge is there before you can jump over. So it's about knowing the challenge but yet confronting the challenge and not letting the challenge define your levels of hope. This is true in a regular day, it's true in a week, it's true in a month, it's true in a year, it's true in a lifetime. It happens on so many different levels that we have challenges and the challenges are real, but we don't let it define our levels of hope. This, of course, connects so beautifully to a story that I've told, I think I've told more than once, but a story in the Gemara, in the Talmud, about Rabbi Akiva and his colleagues who came to Jerusalem after the temple was destroyed. And they saw a fox coming out of the place of the Holy of Holies, complete desecration and desolation happening on the Temple Mount, the most holiest spot to the Jewish people. And they tore their clothes, and so did Rabbi Akiva. Because that's actually part of Jewish practice, that when you go to that spot, you tear your clothes if you haven't been there for a long time as a sign of acknowledging the destruction. So they both tore their clothes, but then Rabbi Akiva's colleagues started to cry. Understandably so. And Rabbi Akiva started to laugh. And they asked him, why are you crying? So he said to them, so why are you crying? They said, what do you mean why are we crying? We are crying because this is the place about which it says in the Torah that no stranger shall go there. Only the Kohen Gadol, only the high priest can go there on the holiest day of Yom Kippur, going into the holiest spot. And now foxes are roaming around and we shouldn't cry. So he said, that's why I'm laughing. I'm laughing because I see that this desolation, this descent is making room for an unbelievable growth to take place. Because it says in the Tanakh that there will come a time when Jerusalem will be rebuilt and there will be a temple and there will be the sounds of grooms and brides and the streets of Yerushalayim and so on and so forth. But it also says there will be a destruction. Now that I know the destruction took place, I have what to look forward to. The prophecy, the fulfillment of the prophecy of the total rebuilding of Jerusalem with its temple. And they turned around to Rabbi Akiva, the colleagues, and they said, Akiva nechamtanu, Akiva, you have comforted us. So what's the meaning of the story? Were the people mistaken? Were Rabbi Akiva's colleagues completely mistaken? And also, if Rabbi Akiva was so hopeful, why did he join in tearing his clothes? And the answer is very simple. No, no one was mistaken here. It was two parts of the same equation. We need to learn about the colleagues of Rabbi Akiva. We need to learn about the fact that they cried because challenge is a crying thing. We need to acknowledge challenge. We need to acknowledge the pain. We need to acknowledge the difficulty of getting to where we want to get to if things are difficult, if there's challenging times. We need to understand that and really give acknowledgement to it. That's why we learn about the colleagues that started to cry. And we learn about Rabbi Akiva himself, who acknowledged the challenge by tearing his clothes. But all Rabbi Akiva wanted to say is the challenge is there, but it's a part of the regrowth. It's part of the building. Again, going back to the talks of the Rebbe, the Babaji once asked a question, and he said, an interesting question. He said, you know, when we on Tisha B'Av, we commemorate the destruction of the temple. And he asked the question, how could God destroy the temple? Everything comes from God. Now, what kind of question is that? We weren't behaving ourselves, so he destroyed it. But really, the question was based on the following principle. We have an idea. It's a very interesting discussion in its own right, but we have an idea that God keeps his mitzvot that he tells us to do. He practices what he preaches. In other words, he tells us to do mitzvot, he keeps them. Now obviously God is not a person, and he keeps them in a sort of a spiritual way, symbolic way, whatever the case is. And we find reference to this many, many times in the Talmud. For example, we find about what's written in God's tefillin, for example. Or there's a question someone asks, how can God make it rain on Shabbat because that's like planting. And there's all different answers that are given, but the theme is the same, that God sort of keeps his own mitzvot. One of the laws of the Torah is that a place of worship, a holy place, may not be demolished. You can't just, I mean, there's exceptions to it and there's all kinds of loopholes and stuff, but you can't just demolish a shul or a place of worship or a place of holiness. So the question then is, if God keeps all mitzvot, how could he allow for the temple to be destroyed, the holiest place of worship? How did he allow the temple to be destroyed? And of course, the answer is that there's one case that you're permitted to demolish a synagogue, a place of worship, a holy place. What is that? If you plan to renovate it and to build something nicer in its place. So then you're allowed to destroy it. Why? Because when you destroy a shul in order to rebuild a better one, that's not considered destruction. That's called renovation. Renovation includes destruction. It includes demolishment. I just saw this firsthand. We did a renovation a few months ago. And the first few days, there was tough demolition. Walls came down. Windows were taken out. Kitchen was torn out. All destructive things. Were we upset? No. Why? Of course not. Because when demolishing as part of renovation is part of building. It's part of the building process. Can't put a nicer kitchen if you have the old one there still. So God says, I'm allowing the temple to be destroyed because God is in the process of building a much more beautiful one. He sent us into Galut, he sent us into the exile, but it's all for our own growth. And ultimately to reach a level of divine revelation and the temple and building a regrowth and rebuilding like never before. So therefore, that's what Rabbi Akiva is teaching us. Rabbi Akiva is standing in the temple. He says, yes, it's painful. Even when you demolish a kitchen, it's painful. You're out of a kitchen for a few days, a few weeks. It is painful, but it's part of the building. And this is true with every single challenge that we hope, that we have in our lives. Even the ones that threaten our hopefulness. It's the understanding that as a Jewish people, as a community, we are excellent at knowing that we never give up hope, that we understand that every setback is part of growth, every destruction is part of a rebuilding process. We just need to be able to integrate that within our regular day-to-day lives, that things that happen to us that threaten our optimism, our hopefulness, to understand that whatever happens to us is a part of the growing process, it's part of the rebuilding process. And how do we do that? What's the method? That's the philosophy, but how do we do that? So of course it's the belief, but how do we do that? So I think it's something that we often talk about. It goes back to the heart of what I call Jewish mindfulness. And Jewish mindfulness is a combination of two things, as we've talked about many times. It's having a vision, meaning know where we're going to, but being in the present. As we've said many times, we're supposed to live in the moment, but not for the moment. So what does this mean? First of all, in Jewish mindfulness, we have to look to the future. Because we have a goal, we have a lifelong mission, we have a journey. I've told you this story before, but I'll tell you again because it's beautiful. Reb Mendel Futterfass, a great chassid that I knew. A person who embodied this in the most amazing way. He was full of hope, always. When I say he was full of hope, he lived a terrible, challenging life. At least for the first most part of it. He grew up in Russia. First of all, he was born without a father. His father passed away when his mother was pregnant with him. In fact, when he's called up to the Torah, he's passed on already, but when he was called up to the Torah, his name was Menachem Mendel ben Menachem Mendel, because he was named after his father, his own father. So his mother brought him up in a very trying time during Russia under communism rule. He then was involved, just after the war, he was involved in a window of opportunity to send people to escape the horrors of communism with false passports, Polish passports. There was a whole thing after the war where there was a window of opportunity for people with foreign passports to leave Russia, and he was trying to help much of his brethren do that, and then he got caught himself. He had an opportunity to leave before, but he didn't. He gave up his life to help others, and he got caught, and he spent over 10 years in Siberia. Then he came out of Siberia, and unfortunately, when he was released from Russia and he came to London, his oldest daughter tragically died in a car accident. I'm telling you this because if you ever met this person, you would think he has the best life ever. He was always happy. Not because he didn't understand the challenges. He was not naive. He was a very smart man, a very great person. But he always looked to the goal. He always looked to the future. In fact, he was once asked, Rabbi Mendel Futzfass was once asked, and he said, how did you make it through years, I don't know if it was 10 years or more years, 15 years, how did you make it through the hard labor, the harsh winters of Siberia? How did you manage? You were isolated, you were, had no friends with you, didn't have your chevra with you, so to speak. You didn't see your Rebbe, you were away from holy books and everything. I mean, it's just, you were just there with a bunch of prisoners, the Russian prisoners, Kazakhs. And he says, you know how I managed? I'll tell you why. Because I learned a lesson. You know, the Baal Shem Tov says that everything you see or hear, you have to learn a lesson from. And in the camp, in the hard labor camp, there was all kinds of people. People had come from very decent backgrounds because they were all prisoners of communism, political prisoners, so to speak. And people who had done some amazing things before they got into prison. One of them was a tightrope walker. He worked in a circus. And one day when there was a bit of a public holiday and we were a little bit more relaxed, people turned to this guy and said, come on, give us a show. And they found the rope and they tied it to two trees, faraway trees. And this person jumped up and he walked across. He tightroped. Walked. And afterwards, people sat around with him and asked him, what's the secret? What is the secret? And he said, the secret is you take one step at a time, but you never take your eye off the end, off the goal. That's how you do it. It might be scary. You might be almost falling down to the left side, to the right side. But you stay steady. You stay steady because you're looking at the goal. You know that you need to reach the other side of the rope. When we have challenges in our lives, when we get threatened and we sort of give up, we are at the brink of giving up, we have a goal. We have a future. We have a destination. We have to have our eyes on that destination. We have to visualize what that destination looks like at the end. We all have to have our own personal goals. We have to have a mission statement. And in Judaism, of course, that's connected to our higher values, our greater meaning, our greater purpose, and why we live altogether. We have to know what that looks like long term and always be focused. Okay, there's something happening now that's overwhelming me, but there is a goal. But part of that also is to live in the moment. Because when we have a goal, we don't start running to the goal. If you run over a tightrope, you're going to fall down. You have your eye on the goal, but you take one step at a time. In other words, what it really means is when we say we live in the moment but not for the moment is, we have a vision of where we want to go, but what we do now is completely focused on what can I do now about that vision, not tomorrow. That's what mindfulness is, Jewish mindfulness. In other words, I live for a purpose, I live for a goal, but what I do now is just focusing on what can I do now that will reach that goal. If it's someone stuck in a really challenging situation, it's more of a destructive situation, then you can be resilient, you can be strong, you can build up your emunah, you can build up your faith, you can build up your hope, you can build up your resilience. You might not be able to do anything significant towards that goal now, but you can still do something to be a better person, to be ready to achieve the goal. So it's about having your eye on the vision, on the goal, but taking one step at a time now and doing whatever I can now to reach that goal. Again, that's true with the nation, and we do it very, very well, but we need to be able to do it with ourselves. And as she ends off that chapter, coming back to the book, she gives us a few keys, in summary, how to free ourselves from hopelessness. And she says, part of that is, again, don't cover the garlic with chocolate. Acknowledge the challenge. Understand the challenge is there. Don't pretend that it's not there. Remember that this takes courage not to be discouraged. And we all have that courage. You see, because we all have that purpose within us. We all have that soul within us, as we've talked about before. We all have a deep-rooted spark of resilience and hope. It's part of our DNA. The proof of that is that we do it so well as a nation. But it's part of our DNA as an individual as well. And therefore, we have to have that courage not to be discouraged. And then she says something interesting just at the end. She says, hope is an investment in curiosity. In other words, part of hope is, if there's nothing else you can do now, just imagine, start planning, do things, visualize what's happening in the future, and have that hope and that emunah that in fact it is coming. So those two things go together. Both things have essentially, by the at the end of the day, the same strategy. We have a goal, if we have to keep moving. What happened yesterday, what happened in the past, through the trauma that happened to us, the perception of other people, the definition of failure, that's all stuff that's standing in the way. And it's all stuff we have to accept, but we can't let it define the now, and can't let it define the future. So we have to let go of fear. And again, we have to do what we can now, just take one step at a time. But that's so true with hopelessness as well, because yes, we have challenges, and we're not naive about the challenges, but we have our eye at the tightrope, we have our eye on the goal, and then we take one step at a time. What can I do now to reach that goal a little bit further? So I'm going to leave it at that. And just to remind everyone the following, that next week, again, for those who came a bit late, I just want to mention this again, really, really important. First of all, next week, we still have one more session, the last session of 2020. That's next Thursday morning, same link, same time. We will just put it all together, talk about some of the things she says at the end of the book, and also connect it to Hanukkah, which starts next Thursday night. Then we're going to take a break, and then Bina generally starting a 7-week program, so to speak, of the summer with Bina. There's some emails about it. There'll be WhatsApps. Please pay attention to the details, because many people are still here. So a lot of us are taking off different times. There's not going to be the same formal shiurim, but we're going to have lots of different daily opportunity of learning, WhatsApps, messages, videos. So sign up for them if you can, and keep yourself inspired throughout the 7 weeks of the summer. There'll be some classes also, but just watch all the notifications, and see you next week, hopefully this time. And I wish you all a wonderful day. And Shabbat Shalom.
Thank you. Bye.